Hello, everybody. Welcome to Beyond the Matrix, the program that dares you to think outside the box of convention and take your mind into the free thought zone, which is what I'm here for, to, in whatever way possible, to help you do, and in my small contribution to trying to make this world a better place. And to do that, I have a remarkable guest with me tonight. But before I talk about him, I do have to remind you that this is pre-taped. It's not live, because as you're listening to this, I am still going to be in Peru, climbing the highest peaks, probably the highest peaks, if I can get myself up there, in Peru in search of new adventure and wisdom and the word of indigenous people. So I'll have plenty to talk about when I get back. But I wanted to be sure to have something prepared for you while I'm gone. And as I promised last week, today I'll be talking with Stephen Mailer, someone who I hold in great esteem. He is the author of a number of books now. I'm embarrassed to say I'm behind up-to-dateness on his books, but I am an avid fan of his book, The Land of Osiris, that he developed with my dear brother, Hakim, who has gone to the other side. And we're going to be talking about Hakim. This program is pretty much a memorial to this wonderful man, Hakim Arwan. Did I pronounce that right, Stephen?
It's Arwan.
Arwan. So there he is, Stephen Mailer. Thank you for being with us, Stephen. And I know that we're going to have a very interesting conversation. And I've promised myself not to be sad or maudlin in any way, in honor of the spirit and the laughter and the glimmer in the eyes of Hakim, who has gone on surely to brighter fields.
Thank you. It's an honor, and I'm very glad to talk to you because you are someone who knew him and learned from him too. And so it's personal. It's personal for both of us. And so we will pay our deepest respects for him today.
Indeed. I did know him not as well as you, of course, but in these last few years, I've managed to spend quite a lot of time with him. Never enough, but we were supposed to be together in a few months, in fact, which is a little bit melancholy, but anyway.
Yes, the regrets are something we all have to deal with. I just wrote to someone the other day, and by the way, since he's passed, I have received over 100 emails from people all around the world, many like yourself, whom I have never met, but people who were touched by him, who were moved by his love and his wisdom and his gentleness, and it's just an amazing, amazing thing how many thousands of people that I didn't even know about, hundreds at least, that he touched in his, you know, over 55 years as an active tour guide and teacher, and actually he was a tour guide before they even gave out licenses, and so there's so many people around the world who are moved by his passing.
Well, that really comforts me because I know that his wisdom is far-reaching, and that is also thanks to you. But to know that so many people have been able to get in touch with you and to express this love, it really hurts my heart.
And so many.
So let's talk about, without any more, because I'm going to start crying, and that would be a no-good thing.
No, that's not what he wants either.
That's not what he wants. So I'd like to begin. We're going to have to, for those people that are listening tonight that really don't know who we're talking about, although I find it hard to imagine anyone who has studied Egyptology and hasn't heard of Hakim. But let's just get to the very gritty and start with what are we talking about when we're talking about the Kemet and his wisdom as a keeper, the last indigenous keeper of the Kemetians. Do you agree, or hopefully I'm wrong?
Well, in a way, you are right. There are others, but he was so unique because he was a scholar as well as an indigenous oral teacher. He was a man who got a formal degree in Egyptology and archaeology from what was then called Fouad University. It is now called Cairo University. He actually did graduate work in archaeology at Leiden University in Holland. So he was a scholar. But the amazing thing about this man and why he was unique is that from a young age, from, I would say, 6 years old, he loved to tell this story, and I'd love to pass this story to you, that when he was about six years old, he had an uncle who was an antiquities merchant, which is a big thing in Egypt. So on a windy day, after the winds would come across the Giza Plateau, he would send all the young children out on the plateau looking for artifacts. And if he'd bring whatever they would bring back, he'd give them a couple of coins. Well, Hakim was always a failure at this. He would come back, and his mother, as he always said, she would never look in his eyes, she would look in his hands. And his hands were empty. He never found anything. And she'd say, why? What's the matter with you? She'd say, mishkwais, which means not good in Arabic. He would say that he would go into the tombs, he would look what was written on the walls, and he was fascinated. And from the age of six, he had to know what was said on the walls. And so so he was a failure in that respect. He often told me his father considered him a failure too. So why do you want to do with archaeology? The same thing my father said to me. That's why we had such an affinity. What are you going to do with archaeology? You can't make any money. But
that's
he was
funny.
Unique.
He told
He's
me
unique.
That story at least three times as well.
Right.
And it was very
He was unique because there are other keepers. I've met the keepers, and we can talk about what you mean by keepers. The keepers are the people who keep the oral tradition, who are the guardians of the sites, always in galabeahs, always in native dress, and many don't speak English. So therefore, that's why Hakim was totally unique. He could speak at least five languages that I knew of. He was fluent in English, of course, in German, in Dutch. He could speak French, Spanish, and Italian. He could fake it in Japanese. I saw him do that. Being a tour guide, you have to know all these different languages. So he was totally unique in that he could pass the tradition to the West. And that was his uniqueness. The others, they could care less if people like us come and talk to them. I mean, they're interested, but you'd have to know Arabic to really be able to converse with them. And the sadness that I see is I don't see young people taking their place. The problem is in Egypt today, like all through the Middle East, they're so westernized. They want to have their boom boxes and their iPods and their iPhones.
That's right.
And not listening to the oral tradition anymore. So that is the sadness that I see. So it is up to you and me and his daughters and his whoever else will pick up the mantle to carry it on. But there is, you're right in saying, there is no one like him to take his place. He was utterly unique.
He was. And I would like to think that the work that he did with you, it really does feel to me when I read the work that you've done with him and in the telling that he has so many stories he's told me about being with you, that in many ways he was passing this wisdom on to you, and that in fact you developed it together in a sense of bringing it into a modern context that people could embrace and understand.
That is absolutely correct, and I am blessed, and it moves my heart even to say that we formed a trust and a bond. I met him first in 1992. He began to pass the teachings to me, but it wasn't until 1997 that we really got down to a level where there was this connection between heart and soul. He totally trusted me, and he chose me. You know, of course, every father always wants a son to follow in his footsteps. You know, every father that has a career and occupation, and none of his sons have. And so I became the son that he always wanted, and he treated me as his eldest son. And yes, you're right, and it's a blessing. He passed so much to me. There was so much more that I wish, we talked about regrets. But he passed so much to me, and as we say, he and I developed a whole new discipline. As you mentioned before, we call it Kematology, not Egyptology. Egypt is a Greek word based on Egyptos. I say that in my book, Land of Osiris, and I did write two books with him. The second one is called From Light into Darkness, The Evolution of Religion in Ancient Egypt, where we explain how Judaism, Christianity, and Islam came to be from the religions of ancient Egypt. And I am going to do a third book, because we were deep into a third book about the origins of writing and written script, what he called the Suf language, which was the indigenous title for the hieroglyphs, for the glyphs, how they came to be. And that will be my memorial to him. So, but, I always thought that we would keep going,
Yeah. How is it I missed this book?
I don't know. He had a copy, From Light into Darkness. It came out in 2005.
Well, if he only had one copy, for sure it was tucked away deeply in protection because he held these things so dear to him. I want to tell you something poignant that happened last time I saw him. I said, so what are we going to do? Are you going to help me get into this tunnel? Because every time I was with him, I talked about wanting to get into the tunnel beneath the Sphinx.
Oh, yes.
To the pyramid, and how, they keep telling me there's no tunnel, and it's like, okay. And he said, up until the last time I saw him, really, he always said he would come with me. And the last time he said, I'm not going to make it in with you. And he said, but I'll see you in, and I'll be at the other side when you come through.
There are literally hundreds of tunnels on the Giza Plateau, hundreds of entrances into underground tunnels. That's one of the major things he and I worked with, is that the whole Giza Plateau is honeycombed with tunnels. The tunnels look like water.
Well, sure, it's Rostow. It's the city of tunnels. Isn't that what it means?
Yeah, well, not really, but the tunnels are so amazing, in fact, that the Egyptologists cannot even deal with them. They ignore them. They say that they're natural caverns, or they were, I mean, Zahi Hawass says the tunnels were swimming pools for the dynastic people. I mean, things like that.
Yes, sure.
I have been in the tunnels. He has taken me in. So I, you know, that's one of the things that he said.
So have you been in the tunnel under the Sphinx?
Not exactly under the Sphinx, but one of the tunnels that leads to the Sphinx, that's in Land of Osiris. If you go back to the book, you will see I feature a tunnel there that was, it's an area called the Temple of the Four Guardians. If we were in Egypt together, I could show you where this is, and actually the tunnel, all tunnels under the Giza Plateau lead to the Sphinx.
Stephen, you know, you can't say a thing like that and not expect me to say, when are we going to be in Egypt together?
I know. I'll let you know when I'm going to be. I will keep in touch with you and let you know when I'm going to be there. I'd love to show you just some of the things he showed me. I mean, it's amazing. People cannot ever realize the things that he showed me, because all I've done in the books is just laid on a small percentage of the things that he showed me and taught me. One of the greatest experiences I ever had was in 1997, when he was still physically active, able to get around, and we spent 3 weeks together, not with a tour group, just he and I and my research partner, and we went all over different areas, meeting the keepers, going to places that not even Zahi Hawass has ever seen.
Can you take me? Will you be his legs?
Yes. Yes, that's my role.
Okay.
That's
listen, everyone, you're hearing it on the radio. This is going to happen. What an honor that would be for you.
This is the mantle that he's put on my shoulders. I have to carry on for him. I have to. That is my mission.
I would be so grateful. You know, he wanted to take me to Abu Rab. Garul,
yes, I can take you to Abu Ghraib, Abu Sir. There's so much to see there. And Abu Sir is actually his essential homeland. That's where the Awiyans really come from. So there's many, many family there. And that once they know, and they know me, I mean, the greatest thing he did for me was introduce me to the keepers, introduce me to so many members of his family so that I would be able to continue. I mean, he planned for this. He planned for his passing.
Oh,
he planned for all of this.
Yeah, he definitely did. The last time I was with him, as I said, we talked before we went on air, that we've been actually twice in Egypt at the same time, and twice he said, I can't be with you because, and as soon as he said your name, his eyes just lit up.
Oh.
Stephen's coming.
Oh.
And I said, well, I understand, and the love, it was just so powerful. I really, really want you to know that in my humble presence in that moment, the humble moment of being there with him, your light shone through.
I've never had a connection with another male like I had with him, not even with my father, not even with my brother. I mean, the love and the understanding cannot even be put in words, and I thank you for saying that.
I can imagine, and I know I've heard him and seen him talk about you. So tell me more about your secrets. We need to tell the people. I just can't believe you would be willing to be there with me. We've got to make it happen.
Of course.
Okay.
For those that don't know, you probably maybe have spoken on this on the air, but for your listeners, basically Hakim's teaching was passing the oral tradition. The tradition that exists throughout the world, especially in Africa and Asia and in Europe, now in the Americas with the Native Americans, the tradition that existed before there was writing, the way history was kept. And people have asked me, in fact, I just gave a presentation recently, well, I mean, isn't the oral tradition not dependable? And, you know, people tell stories and you can get it mixed up. And I say, well, you know, we used to give the example of the little game that we played in grade school, and I'm dating myself. When we were kids, we had this game, telephone, where you would tell a message to somebody in the front row, and it would go all through the class, and by the time it came to the last person in the last row, it hardly resembled what the original message was. But that's not what the oral tradition was. The oral tradition was rigorous initiation where you had to sit and memorize these stories, not just listen. You had to be able to repeat them rote. You had to be able to know these facts, know these situations, know these principles, and you were tested and initiated. So that's what the oral tradition is. Very rigorous. And it's an amazing thing, Pat. In just the last 2 years, he told me about his lineage. He told me about his teachers. And it is a tradition of Zen, a tradition that we think only comes from Asia, like in Zen Buddhism. But Zen, he was saying, comes from Africa. And it is a tradition of understanding consciousness, understanding truth. And the truths that he taught were that there was advanced civilization all throughout northern Africa over 10,000 years ago, which was called Chem. We added a T when we became into language and we devised gender nouns. The T ending became feminine. So the land was considered feminine, so it became Kemet. We say Kemet. I put in the vowels. We spell it all differently because there were no vowels in this language. There also were no consonants in this language, and that's what the third book is going to be about. The Greeks invented the alphabet. They invented vowels. They invented consonants, and they imposed that on this language. So that's why we say all the translations of the glyphs by the Egyptologists are wrong, because they're going by a Greek mythology, a Greek misunderstanding. So he learned the symbols. He understood what they meant. He was given these teachings to pass on that there was a highly, highly advanced civilization called Chem, which meant the black land, and where the word, one of the words in Arabic today for Egypt, besides Nisr, is Al-Chem. And so that's where the word alchemy comes from. I tell everyone, all alchemy is the science and arts of ancient Kemet.
In fact, it's funny that you should be talking about that, because that's exactly where I am right now in the book that I'm writing, called Where Pharaohs Dwell, bringing through also the teachings of Hakim and referring a lot to your book, which I think is really one of the most important books that's come through on Egypt.
Well, I think I need to get a copy of From Light to You then. You need to have both.
Oh, I'd be happy to have that, and we'll make a swap, and I'll send you something of mine so we're up to date on what we're both doing.
Excellent, because he just kept taking it each time. Land of Osiris was the introduction. That was to lay the groundwork, to give the understanding of what Kemetology was. And that had to do with the five stages of the sun, the five purrs that we can talk about, that where pyramid comes from, where tomb comes from. I mean, that's the basis of the teachings. But when we went from there, then he went to get deeper. And he gave me these five incredible dictums, which are the foundation of the book From Light into Darkness. And it is really profound, and it takes a lot of explanation. But basically,
you're talking about the five stages of the sun?
Well, he actually made five principles that form the foundation of Kemetology. There is no death, there is no time, there is no separation, there is no God, and there is no soul. And that is the basis of my second book. And it's the last two that people have the most difficulty with. There is no God, and
sure,
there is no soul.
Sure, no God and no soul. You're going to run into a lot of conflict on that.
Of course, but it has to be understood in how he meant that.
Sure.
Basically, you know, his teachings become very Buddhist. In that respect of there is no God and there is no soul, they echo exactly the teachings of Siddhartha Shakyamuni, who we knew as Gautama Buddha. So there is a definite connection with the ancient teachings from Asia with the ancient teachings from Africa. And Hakim always made that link to me. He always would tell me, this comes from Asia, this is Europa, and this is Africa. But he basically taught, and for people to understand, when we're talking about Kemet, Hem, it actually included Africa, Asia, and Europe. So all three continents fed into each other. And I also believe, of course, the ancient Americas, because one of our teachings are that people were traveling all around the world by boat over 10,000 years ago, and people were sharing these things. This is why we see pyramids all around the world. This is why we see similar teachings of the indigenous. And you know,
well, this is where Hakim and I had a, we had a little delicate moment when I dared to discuss Atlantis. And I think you had the same moment with him. And he said, I said, can we embrace the idea that this could have been coexisting with the Kemet?
Absolutely. Then he was there.
Not let this bother you so much, Hakim. Come on.
Like
I said, you're such an open-minded spirit. I said, it doesn't have to imply that there was only the great Atlantis before. Can't we imagine a vastness of wisdom?
Sure, and then he would be okay with it.
You see,
his basic tenet was the theory of Atlantis was used in a racist way. to say that there was this enlightened continent of white people, but, you know, even Casey said Atlanteans weren't white. But this is how a lot of people use this, to say that there was this highly advanced and enlightened continent of white people who had a cataclysm, went down, went to Africa, and taught ignorant people of color how to build pyramids and have civilization. He was adamant against that theory.
But well, that's understandable.
But when you could change it around, and as I called it, the global maritime culture, in that over 10,000 years ago, there were advanced civilization all around the planet, and Atlantis was just a catchphrase for that, then he was okay with it. As long
well,
as you
that's
understood...
exactly what I said to him as well. So I guess we're in sync, because
yes,
when I
yes,
did...
Because you have to understand.
There was a moment when I thought I was not going to get to finish my dinner.
Well, it was like that with me. When I first brought Atlantis up to him in 1992, he totally poo-pooed it. And he totally put down Casey and Plato and everybody as just making a story up. And I, you know, finally we had to get deeper into it to understand where he was coming from. And it has to do with the idea of cycles. So if we had the five stages of the sun, which also represent stages in human consciousness and in prehistory, so we're talking about a cycle over 10,000 years ago, which we call Aten, which means the wiser. It's the highest state of consciousness. So that it couldn't just be an Atlantis and everybody else is in darkness. Everyone was in this stage. Sure, there were different degrees
right.
of it, so there were enlightened people all around. So then, when you come to it with that idea, then he had no problem with Atlantis.
That's right. In fact, he said, okay, I can accept this as long as you are talking about coexisting. I said, I'm talking about an age of enlightenment on this planet.
That was a key. Once you brought that into it, then he was okay.
Yeah, and especially because when I started talking to him about my own, I said, no, these are conjecture. It's conjecture, Hakeem, so bear with me, but just allow me to speak my piece. And he said, okay, I'm allowing it. And I told him that I did envisage Atlantis, not just an island up in the north of the Atlantic, but actually an entire continent that bridged from north to south, which clearly would explain why South America is so closely connected to Asia and Egypt, because there was a continent there, and the bodies of water that were on the sides of this continent were much more navigatable than a gigantic ocean.
Absolutely. In fact,
so
Hakeem and I used to talk about the concept that exists in geology, which they call Pangaea or Pangaea, when all the continents, and you're absolutely right, if people would take a flat projection map of the world and just with a scissors cut out the continents, you put them together into a jigsaw puzzle. Obviously they fit together. Obviously they were all one at one time. And Hakeem tells it that when all the continents were together, Africa was in the heart, was in the center. And then he said, Hemet was the Ib, or the heart of Africa. So that's why he sees it all coming from the heart, from the center of Africa, where the teachings came, then spread out, and then the continents separated. And again, Hakeem and I disagree with the academic field of geology. They're saying the continents actually moved apart millions of years ago. Hakeem was saying it was more like a couple hundred thousand years ago, and that there's much more of a linkage of the continents together than there is. Again, Hakeem, one of his main tenets of teaching was, concentrate on the similarities between people, not the differences.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, you know, when you move around and you see the pyramids, I know you're going to Mexico again, and I've just been back. I keep going back and forth. And so, have you been there yet?
No, this is amazing. As an archaeologist, prehistorian, my concentration has been in Egypt. I've gone 12 times in the last 15 years. I've yet to be to Mexico, finally going, yet to be to Guatemala. I'm going there too. And as you said, you're going to be in Peru. I've yet to go to Peru. But I'm going to be doing all these things now, because it is part of Hakeem's mission for me, is to connect with all indigenous elders all throughout the world if I can. And that's why I'm going to Mexico and Guatemala to connect with the Mayan elders. I want to go to Peru to connect with the elders there. The same that you are doing, I want to do too. But no, I've never been, but Egypt and Europe, that's all.
Well, we're going to have to do some things together, Stephen, because we're all over the same things. We're connected through Hakeem. We're connected through our work. So I'd like to put it out there that we really do plan to do something together, because for us, as well as for the people that we will bring to these places, I'm sure it will be a monumental experience.
I agree, totally.
So when you go to Mexico, either this time or in another moment when maybe you can come with me, you've got to go to aside from the Valley of the Temples in Mexico. You won't believe the size of these huge pyramids. There is another little pyramid called Tula, which you might have heard of.
Tula?
Yeah?
Yes.
It's outside of Mexico, and it's called Tula, the Pyramid of the Atlanteans. And it has these four statues on the top of this pyramid, which is, of course, flat. A lot of the Mayan pyramids are flat at the top, that are just completely otherworldly. They don't resemble Mayan sculptures at all. And they're
beautiful.
Called the Four Atlanteans.
Beautiful. Thanks for sharing that. Beautiful.
You've got to go there. It's not. It's kind of off the beaten track, and a lot of people never get there, but it's
right.
Well worth the hassle to get there, I assure you.
Wow. Have you ever been to Punta Punku? In I think it's Peru, but close to Bolivia.
Punta Punku?
Puma Punku, I think it's called. It shows the same type of megalithic work in granite like there is in Egypt. Same type of technology. Huge blocks, machine blocks of granite.
I'm headed there now because we're going to go up to Machu Picchu.
Puno is
the little city that's at the... I didn't mean to say Machu Picchu. We're going up to Lake Titicaca.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, the reason why I bring it up is a person I'd love to recommend for you and for your listeners is my good friend and colleague named Christopher Dunn, who was very close to Hakim, who was an engineer.
I didn't know he was close to Hakim, but he was just on my show recently.
Oh, great thing, really. Well, he was the Giza power plant. Hakim was the first one to come out as an indigenous elder to support his concept of the pyramid, of course, was
Hakim. Oh, that's wonderful. I want
you
to know
Chris
we're having on, and at a certain point during the show, he said, Patricia, but you're pulling stuff out of me that I didn't expect I would be talking about.
Excellent. As well, see, Chris is now seeing this type of technology all around the world, and he really points to Puma Punku, of all, even more than Sacsayhuaman, even more than other sites, all like Tetambo. He said this really makes the link with the same technology that was used in ancient Kemet, the working planet.
Okay, so it's called Puma Punku, and it's located near Bolivia?
I think
at the border.
Peru or Bolivia, near there. I can get the information to you. I think it's in Peru or very close to Bolivia, but it's up high.
Okay, everybody, I'll get this information for Stephen, and I'll find a way to get it on my site. So if you want to know about this, be sure to check my site within a week or two, and I'll have it up for you. And while
Excellent.
We're talking about sites, Stephen, do you have a
yes.
website where people can come and find out all the great work you're doing?
Yes, I am the director of research of the Great Pyramid of Giza Research Association. Chris Dunn is also on the advisory board. So the address is www.gizapyramid.com. Very easy. And a lot of pictures of Hakim up there and a lot of articles I've written and things like that.
Okay. So what do you say to the fact that when I was asking, I'm particularly interested in Abydos, and we'll talk about that in a minute, but when I was talking to Hakim recently, I said, come on, Hakim, come clean. What do you think the real date of the Osirian is? And he said about between 35,000 and 50,000 years old.
Well, I think
which
you
is
mean
how
the
he pretty much dates.
Oh, the Osirian? Yeah, yes. I'm sorry. I thought you meant the temple in the front, because the temple of Osiris that's so-called dated to Seti I of 19th dynasty, we dated to 4,000 B.C. So, yes, the Osirian in the back dates to the time of the Sphinx. 50,000 years.
50,000. Okay, so this is just really hot stuff.
Oh.
Have you been in
you
there?
You can just... are you kidding? I spent extensive time. The Osirian is one of those anomalies that they cannot explain. They try to date it as being similar to the temple in front, but it's 50 feet lower. I mean, you don't have to have a PhD in archaeology to know if something is 50 feet lower as a stratigraphic layer than it's something else. It has to be older. So, and there are inscriptions on the Osirian, but they're obviously put on later. This was the same megalith, and it's the only temple in Upper Egypt made of granite. The only one. All the other temples you see at Luxor, at Karnak, are made of sandstone, which is a temple with a stone that they used in dynastic times because it's much softer, much easier to use. They no longer worked in granite and used a lot of limestone, which is typical of Phoenician archaeology, architecture. But the Osirian is totally megalithic blocks of granite, some weighing 100, 200, 300 tons. They cannot.
I know, it's so ludicrous to hear the classic explanation that because they found an inscription from Seti I, that this meant it was built in contemporary with Seti I, when you see, like you said, it's what, I think 70 feet below?
Oh, yes, at least 50 feet, yes. And it was an incredible teaching temple. The Flower of Life is there. The Flower of Life was not original. Hakim always said it was probably put on between 1 to 200 BC to 200 AD. I believe it was followers of Pythagoras who were studying sacred geometry at the Osirion who put the Flower of Life there. It's in red ochre paint. It's fading away, but it's still there. Each year I go back and take my groups there. It's getting dimmer and dimmer. So that's one of these, things that's going to disappear, and I'm glad we have photographs of it. But the Osirion is an incredible experience because it is at least, 30,000, as he said. He dated it to me at the time of the Sphinx, as old as the Valley and Sphinx Temple, which he dates around 50,000 years by the Sphinx. Of course,
yeah,
50, he dates the Sphinx.
Years.
He dates the Sphinx at being 54,000. Did he ever explain to you how he dates the Sphinx?
No.
Okay, listen to this. Beautiful. This is an indigenous way of calculating. The Sphinx, when she was built, and she, of course, the key operative word, she's Tefnut, she represents the Great Mother, in no way was she built as a male king making offering to the sun. That's utter nonsense. The Sphinx is Tefnut, she represents the Great Mother. So when she was originally carved, she was supposed to look directly east, not only to the rising of the sun, but to the cyclical rising of Sirius around July 23rd each year. But now, Hakim says, as he's observed so beautifully in his 82 years he was on the planet, how now the sun rises, he says, almost 22 degrees, two cycles, he says, off from due east. So he dates a cycle, as the Comedians did, as being 26,000 years, what they called a great year, a full precession of the equinoxes. He says she's two cycles off. 26 times two is 52. So he says 54,000 years. That's how he dated her.
She's definitely, my work is involved with the Syrians. So this is one of the big links I have with Hakim.
Yes, because, the Sphinx definitely represented Sirius. No doubt about it.
So many of the letters, like
Wizard Osiris, like Azed Isis, like Toph, like Jehuti, almost so many of them were connected with Sirius. No doubt about
it.
The Phoenicians believed at least a major part of their ancestry came from the star system Sirius.
So what do you think is the connection between the Osirion and the Sphinx?
The Osirion was an original temple to Wizard Osiris. So it shows that the concept of Wizard Osiris goes way, way back before dynastic times. It was a pre-dynastic, prehistorical understanding. So that was a temple to, let's say, Osiris. And according to the tradition, the original tradition, Plutarch came up with the idea that when Set, people have to understand the Egyptology, I'm jumping ahead, but Set, the evil brother, attacks his brother Osiris, and the Greeks passed down to the Romans that it was 14 pieces, so that's why there are 14 main temple sites. But the original story, Hakim tells us, is that he was broken into 42 pieces, because there were 42 original tribes. So the head of original Osiris was supposed to be at Abydos. And that's why the Osirion was built there. But the amazing teaching is what Wizard really represents is wholeness, totality. And so he says now we're representing polarity. We're split. The tribes have been scattered. We're scattered. So to come together now, one of the missions we all have is each part of the 42 original tribes of Kemet has to bring back their peace of the puzzle, of Wizard, to come together so that we become whole again. And that's what he called the awakening. That's what the major thrust of his teaching were. We're coming to the end of the cycle of Amun, Imun, darkness. We're coming out to Cheper, the dawn, the scarab beetle, the new dawn of consciousness. And to do that, all the 42 tribes have to bring back their piece of the whole together to become whole again. And that's really the story of Osiris being broken into pieces by his evil brother.
Yeah. Whew. Can you give us a bird's eye view, which is a big undertaking, of the five suns and the five eras that you've just glazed over so quickly, but can you elaborate that a bit for
the five
person
stages?
Who maybe doesn't have that background information?
Are you talking about the five stages of the sun?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. That is one of the foundation of his teachings. He said that there's five daily cycles of the sun. And what they represent is not only a daily cycle, they represent levels of consciousness, and they represent stages in prehistory. First stage, the dawn, is Cheper, the scarab beetle. and they called it the driller. Why? The scarab beetle, which is a hermaphrodite, both male and female, when it lays its egg, it then takes the egg, rolls up a ball of dung from any animal, usually camels, whatever's in, around, and puts the egg in there and pushes the ball in front of it. And, you know, people look at, well, that's ridiculous. But it's not ridiculous. Of course, when the infant is born, the infant immediately has an immediate source of food. But how they saw it is the scarab beetle would be pushing the ball in front of it. They saw that as a symbol of the sun coming up. So they used the scarab to represent dawn. It's pushing the ball of the sun up at dawn. So that's the driller. Second stage, which people think is the sun god, is Ra. Ra is only one-fifth of this understanding. So immediately when I lecture, I tell people, oh, you think Ra is a sun god? Wrong. No such thing. It's one-fifth. But Ra represents the stubborn, depicted by a ram, because in the ancient time, more than a donkey, they considered the ram to be a very stubborn animal. And why did they call it stubborn? Well, it represents the sun at noon. It also represents adolescent consciousness. So we know that when we're teenagers, all of us who've had children or know when we were one, when we're teenagers, we think we know everything, and we're stubborn to learn something new. So that's why they use that symbol. Third stage is called Un. And usually it's depicted as a mature man standing upright. It represents a stage called the wise. The sun in early afternoon, when it's getting bright and strong. So therefore, we then come to a level of consciousness. We have wisdom, understanding. We're wise. The fourth stage is the ultimate, as far as I'm concerned. It's called Aten, also pronounced Iten. And if people know about the great person, and my book, From That Into That, deals with a particular individual who used the title Akhenaten. Aten represents the wiser, depicted by an old man on a staff, like Hakim was definitely Aten, hunched over, holding a staff. You're wise, the wiser, wiser. It represents the sun at its height, at the height of the day, the total unflowering of consciousness. It represents a stage of enlightenment. Basically, we're saying in the stage of Aten, we were all enlightened to different degrees, to be sure, but it is a stage of full flowering of consciousness. Then, of course, we go to the fifth stage, which is night, darkness, called Amen or Imen, which represents no image. They call it the hidden. Darkness has no image. And this is where the Jews got the whole idea of that there's no image of God. Nothing about Judaism is original, as I explain in my book, From Light Into Darkness. And so this is where it comes from. Originally, Amen was to have no image. Later, though, in dynastic times, when they developed religion, they gave Amen first a symbol of a ram, then later as a man. As you see, I could show you on the walls, he was depicted as a man. But originally, Amun was to have no image. It's dark, night. Originally, the name means the hidden, so there was to be no image. And folks, everyone, this is where we have been now. For the last 5,000 years, we have been in the low end of the cycle. So this is where we always tell people, we think we today are the most enlightened, highly developed species of human ever been on the planet. And as my good friend John Anthony West, it's a dated quote, but I always like to use it. He says, yeah, we're so enlightened today with our striped toothpaste and our hydrogen bombs. Of course, striped toothpaste dates. It comes from the 60s. But it's true. What Hakim was telling us is no. We're in the lowest stage of the cycle. We're in darkness. We're split. The tribes are split. And this is what's caused religion to evolve, which is what I explained in the second book. And so we're coming out of that now. This was the basis of his teachings. We're preparing for a new chapter, a new dawn, and he called it the awakening.
So we are definitely not preparing, according to Hakim, to enter the age of enlightenment.
Not fully enlightenment, but certainly will be a lot more than we are now. I mean, this is what we see. And always when I would go see him, like you say, you saw in the last couple of years, I would talk to him about politics, about what's happening on in the world, with the terrorism, the fundamentalism, with this and all that. And I would say, gosh, Papa, this is, and I always called him Papa, this is an example. I mean, when are we going to see the dawn? Everyone's always asking me. And he'd say, never fear. And he never had a doubt. He never had a doubt that this is going to happen.
He never had a doubt. I agree.
He said, people are waking up every day. And sure, you see that in your show. Your work is an example of that. My work is an example of that. The people we take to Egypt, when you show them these things, when you experience these things, it is happening. It may be not as fast as we want, but he said within the next few years, things were really going to take off. And the sad thing is, he's not here with us to experience the awakening. But the good thing is, he's going on the other side to help bring it in. No doubt about it.
Yeah, I was going to say, he's not here with us physically, but he's probably sitting wherever that place is, having a good old laugh, saying, I'm here, I can hear you, and I have something to say.
And as I said, he never had any doubt, he never wavered that this was the way it was going to be. As he always said to me, and sometimes people think me arrogant and egotistical, because when I lecture I say this, that this is not theory. Hakim was not presenting theory. This is the way it is. Either you accept it or you don't. But it's not something we have to debate. We don't debate these things. It is or it isn't. And he never wavered for 1 minute that these cycles are the exact basis of his teaching and that this cycle is coming to an end. As bad as it looks, we always say it's always darkest before the dawn.
Yeah, a whole great spirit on that. Let's bring on the dawn already.
Yeah. I can tell you a good thing that I use, and it helps me a lot, and that Hakim really imparted to us, that we have to be the scarab beetle now. A great teacher, master who I always loved, was Rajneesh, who was originally called Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, later became known as Osho. He always used to talk that the difference between active waiting and passive waiting. Someone would ask, you know, there's really nothing we can do. The grass grows by itself. And he'd say, that's true. But there's a difference when you are aflame, when you're out there being part of the change. And that's what Hakim wanted us to be. To us, the teachers, the ones he taught, the ones he imparted this to be the beetle now. We have to push the dawn. We have to go out there and make the effort to bring the sun in now to the dawn. And that's our work, Pat, you and I and everyone that followed him.
And I think we're doing... I don't want to say a good job because I don't want to stroke my own ego, but I do want to say that we are honoring that desire and that intention of Hakim and other teachers we've had to serve and, as best as possible to help bring that fearlessness to people, above all.
Absolutely, and that's how he lived his
life.
Because
you can find all the information you want.
That was a big issue with him, to live totally without fear. And I'll tell you how I get it, and I'm sure you get it. If you talk to a group of people or you meet people and you just have one person that you're talking to and you look at and you can see it in their eyes that they go, aha, I get it. That makes it all worthwhile.
Yeah, or if they don't maybe get the knowledge, but they get the fearlessness.
Something happens. That's all.
Yeah, something happens. To know if
people
say...
He talked about us having 360 senses, which are the netters. And people would always say, well, how can we activate these senses? If we have these senses, how can we activate them? He would say, the first thing is to know that you have them, that there are more than five senses that we're dealing with. The people we call psychic or sensitive, or say you're using your sixth sense, or using these other abilities, we don't have the labels. This is what he and I were working on, to try to get people to realize that you have these senses that are innate within us, and that's the awakening, to first know that you have them.
In fact, I'll tell you a little anecdote. Years ago, I taught a workshop in San Diego, and I did an interview to promote the program. And so the interviewer asked me, so it must be so wonderful to be Patricia Corey with all of your gifts. And I said, I don't have any other gifts that nobody else has. It's wonderful to be me, yeah, but I'm just a simple person like everyone else.
Beautiful.
And
that's
the woman called up the radio station and said, if Patricia Corey doesn't think she's special, why am I supposed to take her workshop?
I could answer that because she has an inkling, because she has a clue that can help others. That's all.
Well, I'll never forget that. I always use as an example to people about the lesson of humility and just being in delightful awareness that as long as you think you know nothing, maybe you've got something. But as soon as you think you know everything, you know nothing.
Right. Exactly true. That's a great story about Socrates that tells that there was a king of Athens one time sent his minister, I want to find the wisest man in all Greece. And they said, well, of course, that's Socrates. Everybody agrees. He says, go get Socrates. They brought Socrates to the king. He says, okay, you're the wisest man on earth. Tell me something. He said, oh, no, dear king, your advisors are quite wrong. I only know one thing, that I know nothing. And the king went nuts, and he called all his advisors. What are you telling me? This guy's the wisest man in all of Greece, and he tells me he knows nothing. And they said to him, but king, this is why he's the wisest man in all Greece. Because he knows that he knows nothing.
It's so important. You know, I pound and pound and pound on this about the almighty ego and how it so much wants to dominate that it just takes us off path all the time. And one of the beautiful things about being in Hakim's company as well, he being one of the truly wise men of the planet, he was always in simplicity and humility.
And he was an absolute master at bringing you down. Anytime my ego would get out of control around him, he would destroy it. He would tear me apart when I'd realize, gee, I really don't know nothing compared to this man. What am I trying to go off on? He was a master at gently and lovingly tearing your ego to pieces.
Yeah, I remember an author, and I can't remember the name of the book, but an author who did a book about interviewing the Dalai Lama and other great lamas. It was something about a tribute to the elders of Tibet.
Yes.
And she talks the tale about how she went to interview the second Dan after Dalai Lama. He was an elder about 84 years old, and she finally got an interview with him. He never did interviews, and sorry for me to go off track here, but it's too cute. I've got to give it to you, this story.
Sure.
So
sure.
Anyway, she gets the interview and goes up, and he sits there and takes, you know how the Tibetans are, they look at you for about an hour before they speak.
Exactly.
And he finally said to her, why don't we start by you telling me everything you know about Buddhism. Okay, so this poor innocent person says, well, if you'd like me to talk about it, I know about the basic tenets and the wheel and the whole reincarnational, she gives him the whole learned Buddhist information. And he takes about another hour break. He goes, mm-hmm. I mean, why don't you tell me everything you know about love?
Ooh.
She says, well, love as, you know, unconditional expression between two people, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
And finally he takes his seat and he looks at her and he, after about another half an hour, says, well, you've already told me everything there is to know about Buddhism and everything there is to know about love, so what can I possibly tell you?
Oh, God.
And this great author, she said, talk about getting a quick lesson in humility.
Exactly.
But I thought that was so powerful and certainly very representative of Hakim's approach. Because I did bring a few people to him a couple of times who dared.
You know, it was always a dream of mine to be able to bring the Dalai Lama to sit with Hakim. I mean,
that would have been an encounter.
He has had Tibetans have sat with him, but you know, not the Dalai Lama. But that would have been the meeting of two incredible giants. Two incredible.
Oh, yeah. You know, when I was in Tibet years ago before it really, really got overtaken, I had the opportunity to go into the Dalai Lama's summer palace and go into his meditation room. And I could tell you, it was like a nuclear power plant.
I'm sure.
The energy was so amazing in that space that it was so bright you could barely be in it. Still,
right.
After 35 years of exile.
Wow. And it is not out of line that we're discussing that, because as I say in the book that I'm going to send to you, From Light into Darkness, Hakim's teachings, the oral tradition of Africa, is very similar to the teachings of Buddha. Very, very similar.
Oh, yeah, I know. I definitely can agree. Well, you know, the bottom line, Stephen, is when you touch the truth, it doesn't matter where it comes from.
Exactly.
And, you know, when you talk to Hakim, you get right to the truth. Punto.
Exactly.
Period.
And it's amazing.
You know, the same thing. It's always the same. When you really get, when you strip away all of the human impositions on religion and behavior and mindset, and you get down, even in all religion, which I'm not crazy about, you get down to the essence, the core of it, it's always the same.
Yes, and that's why you're going to enjoy my second book, because that's what it's really about.
Oh, I'm really grateful for the book. I can't wait to see it. And let's tell everybody again the titles of the book. We've got Land of Osiris, which is
Land of Osiris,
quite
which
a while
is an introduction to Kemetology. It's Adventures Unlimited Press. Second book is From Light into Darkness, The Evolution of Religion in Ancient Egypt, also Adventures Unlimited Press. And I've just written a book with David Atchicholas. It's off the subject. It's about crystal skulls, called Crystal Skulls, Astonishing Portals to Man's Past. So I have two books out and one co-authored, and I will be starting. I mean, this is amazing, too. When he passed, you know, I started to go on all these. I was going to do these ceremonies and light candles and do these rituals, and he immediately stopped me and said, no, you're going to start on the book. You need to do this now. This is your work with me. And so he's urging me now to get out there and get on this book, and I'm going to do that as soon as I can, you know, get myself back together.
Yeah. I know. I'm also having trouble going ahead with my book because I'm talking about him and understand your work with him, and I'm kind of like not able to move past it at the moment, but I will because I do have a deadline as well. But before we go any further, I do want to ask you, you know, here we are again with all these synchronicities, and of course I am very involved with Crystal Skulls as well. In fact, I brought a group a couple of years ago down to Mexico and to do a crystal skull ceremony, and I ended up having a shaman come into the ceremony. Big things happened, and so I'm amazed. Well, I shouldn't be amazed. Delighted that you are also on this track.
Yes. And Hakim was very interested in crystal skulls, too. He was fascinated by them. And again, the reason I got into this was a couple of great people, and I worked with a Mayan priest with crystal skulls, so that's what I'm going to be doing in Mexico and maybe a year after in Guatemala, is going to the shamans, going to the daykeepers, the wisdom keepers, and learning the indigenous tradition about crystal skulls. And that's what we're going to be featuring on the tours that I'm going to be doing and the work that I'm going to continue.
And I'm doing one, too. I have been baptized by a Mayan priest as a sister, as a sacerdotessa, they say in Italian.
Oh.
And he gave me a crystal skull during the ceremony, which was very powerful. So I am also going back there. Too bad we're not going together, but I have a feeling somewhere down the road we might want to join forces, as we said earlier, and do some of these things together.
I think that's what he wants us to do. I mean, I'm getting emails now from people who led tours from Australia, yourself, people from England who knew Hakim, brought their groups to Hakim that I didn't even know about. And so we're all connecting now, and I think that's what he wants. He wants us, you know, we're his children now, to continue to work and to work together, absolutely.
That makes it a little bit easier to bear with his departure.
That's what he wanted. He set this up. I see now a whole pattern of things he did with me for the last 10 years that was setting up for the moment where he wouldn't be here anymore. And he would know that. I can pass this to you, Pat. There were times where I would be sitting with Hakim, and a lot of times the communication with us was not verbal. It was nonverbal. And there's a great photograph. And there were times where I would look at him and I would start to get into this ego or this third dimensional thinking about when he would be gone and that I wouldn't be working with anyone. I'd start to get sad and get emotional. And he would immediately look at me and he would say, stop that. I'm here and I'm always be with you. Stop thinking that way. And he would know it immediately. So I used to think that a lot. But no doubt in my mind now that he, for the last 10 years, was preparing me for when he wouldn't be here anymore.
Yeah, well, last time I was with him, he wasn't really doing very well. I mean, he still, as you said before we got on the air, he still had that fire, but I could see that he was really not well. And I told him, I said, you know, I really wish I could take you away from here and take care of you somehow. I know this sounds ridiculous. And
no.
He laughed and he said, it doesn't sound ridiculous. It just sounds like you're in your ego. And I said, I just want to protect you and take care of your feet. And he said, I don't need protection. Just always know I'm always with you and always know that the love is there, always there. And just
we all thought that way. He came to the United States in 2006 and he stayed 2 weeks with me, with my wife in Colorado. And it was an exquisite experience. And he loved it. He had such a good time. And I wish he could have stayed here. But, you know, he was where he wanted to be. How many of us in the West can say that we pass away in the same house that we were born in? And we lived in the same house for 82 years.
Just talk about that house, because for those of you that are listening, you have to know that Hakim had a house smack dab looking at the Sphinx, which is a picture I'll put on my website.
Even more so, from his bedroom, when you open up the door, on the way he was sleeping on his bed, when he would wake up every morning, the first thing he would see was Tefnut, the Sphinx. And that's where he passed.
How strong is that?
And that's where he passed. He passed under the guise of the Great Mother, who loved him so much. So, I mean, he died in the same exquisite way he lived.
Yeah. And I'm sure he was surrounded by people that loved him.
His family. His children. Yeah. You know, for people who want to know, he had 11 children, 8 sons and 3 daughters, and there was another grandchild born this year that made 20. So he had 20 grandchildren. That's his legacy as far as family. What
I didn't know he had 20 grandchildren.
20 grandchildren.
So he was prolific in every way.
Every possible way.
Stephen, what do you, if you could tell people what was his legacy, what comes from the lifetime of Hakim. I mean, we've talked about so much of it, but and of course, it's so hard to synopsize a man's lifetime, a man like Hakim particularly.
The biggest
but
thing
if you were to say, what did Hakim leave us, if you could try to put it into a few words, what would that be?
Yes, he could say that actually in his own words. He said, it's time to teach, not preach, and to be in love and integrity and try to exist without judging an other. To see the good, to see the positive in every person, everything. To only see both sides of a situation, not concentrate on the negative, and not only concentrate on the positive. And a classic example, I can give it quickly, is he would talk about, we used to talk about greed, that the greed in the world, the politicians, the greed, greed, greed. And he said to me, you know, but Stephen, what's the other side of greed? And I said, what? He said, self-love. No organism could exist, could continue to survive without self-love. So he always was saying to see both sides of the situation, try not to judge, and to live in love and integrity. And he certainly lived his life that way.
And if I had a glass of champagne now, I would raise it to the sky, say, Hakim, this one's for you.
Absolutely. Everybody should. It's all for
you. So we've got a metaphorical glass of champagne raised to the heavens, because we know, Hakim, we know you can hear us and you can feel the love of all these people that are celebrating your life. You can feel it, you can hear it, and we know that you're still guiding us from above. And a big aho, great spirit to that.
Aha. Aho.
Well, Stephen,
as he would say, yakini, yakini. Did he teach you that one?
No.
Yakini, yakini. It's to be said twice in one breath. It means I'm protected by the power of my positive. The first yakini means protection. The second yakini means you know what you know. No, it's not from a book. It's what you've experienced. The knowingness that you know, that will always protect you. So it's a protective mantra that he always gave to everyone. You can spell it how it sounds phonetically. Spelling is not important. It's the sound. Yahini, yahini. I am protected by the power. I am protected by the power of my positive.
Are you pronouncing it yahini?
Yeah, well, he did that because it's a KH, yahini. But, you know, most people say yahini,
yahini, yahini. Remember those words. Stephen, our time is just about up, unbelievably.
Unbelievable.
Good Lord, how the time flies.
But we got a lot in for this hour. It was pretty amazing.
We did, and I'd like to suggest that you're going to come back and talk to us about your new work, which Hakim is pushing you to get done.
Yes.
And your new discoveries, and this is the beginning of, well, it's probably not the beginning because we've probably been connected many lifetimes, but for sure it's a new adventure for me. Getting closer to you and having the hope of being together with you and maybe others in some really remarkable moments in Egypt.
Let's do that.
Okay. All right, everybody. We've been talking to the wonderful Stephen Mailer. His books, he's listed for you already. I want you to start with Land of Osiris. It's a masterpiece, and it's bringing forward the wisdom of the great Hakim Arian. And with this, I have to say goodbye. I'm still in Rome, but you have to imagine me atop the mountain looking for, what was the name of the place?
Punta Punco.
Puma Punco. You're going to send me information about that, right?
I will.
Okay, and I've got trips coming up. As you know, I'm in Peru now. I'll be in Egypt with another group in January. I'm going to convince Stephen to come and do something with me, too, in Egypt for all of you. So stay tuned at www.SyrianRevelations.net and keep abreast of what we're doing, which is getting yourself to the power points of this planet and celebrating your life and the greatness of this beautiful world, our planet Gaia. Farewell, everyone. Talk to you next week. Goodbye, Stephen. My heart goes out to you. I send you love, 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 and I can't wait to be together.
Ciao, cara.
Ciao, cara. Ciao, cara. Ciao, cara. Ciao, cara. Ciao, cara. Ciao, cara.